On the record in the matter of Dwyer versus the Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services, case number 031202. This case is the third test case to consider within the context of the omnibus autism proceeding, whether thimerosal-containing vaccines have caused the autism spectrum disorder of an individual petitioner. This case is thus a continuation of proceedings that began June 12, 2008, wherein my two colleagues, Special Masters Hastings, Campbell Smith, and I heard the testimony of a number of expert witnesses on the general question of causation, as well as evidence specific to two other petitioners. This week's proceedings will involve factual and expert testimony regarding the specific claim brought under the Vaccine Act by Mr. and Mrs. Dwyer, who are present here with us in the courtroom today, on behalf of their son, Colin. Consistent with the requirements of the Vaccine Act, this case has been assigned to me, Special Master Denise Vowell, to determine whether the Dwyers are entitled to compensation under the vaccine program for Colin's injuries, and I alone will decide Colin's particular case. I understand that we're going to hear the testimony of both Mr. and Mrs. Dwyer today. While they're bringing a specific claim on behalf of their son, Colin, they've also agreed to permit their case to be heard as a test case in the joint proceeding known as the Omnibus Autism Proceeding, or sometimes referred to as the OAP. These proceedings were designed as an efficient method to develop a body of evidence that will help the special masters to resolve approximately 5,000 individual vaccine claims filed by families on behalf of their children who have a disorder on the autism spectrum. The OAP permits the hearing of expert medical and scientific testimony within the context of an actual case that also serves as a test case on the general causation issue of whether routinely administered childhood vaccines can cause autism. The test case is decided on its particular facts, and the general causation evidence that is heard may be applied later in other specific cases. In June, my two colleagues heard the evidence specific to the test cases of King and Mead, and originally a third test case assigned to me was scheduled to be heard at the same time, but petitioners in that case elected to withdraw from the OAP shortly before the hearing. Thereafter, the Dwyer family graciously volunteered to have Colin's case heard as the third test case, but logistical difficulties prevented it from being presented along with the King and Mead cases. And as I indicated when I met you earlier today in the courtroom, we're all extraordinarily grateful to the Dwyer family for stepping forward and permitting Colin's case to be heard as our third test case. Based on the sensitive and confidential nature of evidence in vaccine cases and the statutory protections against disclosure of evidence in such cases, most vaccine hearings are not open to the public. Mr. and Mrs. Dwyer, like the two families who had their test cases heard in June, have taken the unusual and courageous step of permitting public access and public disclosure of most of the evidence in Colin's case so that other families affected by this omnibus proceeding have the benefit of hearing and reading the testimony that may help us resolve their claims. Respondent has consented as well. The digital recordings of this hearing will be posted to the court's public website. Today we anticipate just a one-time posting, and tomorrow we should have it posted twice, both at the noon break. We'll post the transcript, the audio transcript of the morning's hearings, and then after the conclusion of the proceedings, we'll post the remainder of the transcript. Eventually, the written transcript of these proceedings will be similarly posted. Because the evidence in each of the three test cases may be available to help us resolve other cases in the OAP, Special Master Campbell Smith is also present here in the courtroom to listen to the testimony today, and Special Master George Hastings will be joining us at some point. They are the other two special masters, as I've indicated, who are assigned to the autism docket. I anticipate that these proceedings will last 2 days. They will begin with the opportunity for brief opening statements by counsel, followed by presentation of petitioner's evidence. Respondent will then present evidence, and if desired, each side may present rebuttal evidence, followed by closing arguments. After the transcripts are completed, the parties will have the opportunity to file post-hearing briefs, and in due course, I will enter a written decision in this case. And turning just briefly to some housekeeping matters, I remind you that we are guests in this courtroom, and if you would comply with the courtroom rules and concerning eating and drinking in the courtroom, the marshals will not be forced to evict anyone. Turning then to the timing of the case. We'll likely finish early today due to the unavailability of one of petitioner's witnesses. For the same reason, we'll begin early tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock, and we will probably continue tomorrow until the case is completed, which I anticipate would be around the usual closing time of 5 to 6 p.m. We also have a difficulty with one of the respondent's witnesses, and for that reason, the parties agreed in a status conference on Friday that if rebuttal evidence from that expert is needed, it can be filed in writing at the conclusion of the case. And at this time, I would remind you all to power down any cell phones, BlackBerries, or other electronic devices that may interfere with our recording of today's proceedings. All right. Are there any matters we need to take up on the record before we begin with opening statements?
Not for the petitioners.
Not for this time.
All right. Mr. Powers, you may proceed with opening statement.
Thank you, Special Master, and good morning. My name is Tom Powers. I'm one of the attorneys for the Petitioner Steering Committee, and I'm one of the attorneys that is here today assisting in the representation of the Dwyer family in the presentation of their son Colin's claim for compensation. Also at council table with Mr. and Mrs. Dwyer, our attorney Mike Williams, my law partner, and the co-chair of the Petitioner Steering Committee Executive Committee that's been working on the OAP cases for the last 5 and a half, almost 6 years now, and James Farrell, the attorney from Houston, Texas, who's been representing the Dwyer family for the pendency of their claim in the program, also 5, nearly 6 years now. I'll keep my opening comments brief, Special Master, and I'll keep them brief because you actually covered some of them in your introduction. The case that we are hearing today is the case of Colin Dwyer. He's a young boy, soon to be a young man, who was exposed per the pediatric vaccine schedule to a number of the standard childhood immunizations, and a number of those immunizations did contain thimerosal. Thimerosal, as you know and the parties are all well aware, is the central issue in terms of the causation in this round of test cases. As you, Special Master, alluded to, there's been a significant body of general causation evidence that's been developed in these proceedings so far in this second round of test cases. That is that thimerosal, in and of itself, without regard to any other immunization on the schedule, can be a substantial contributing cause to the development of autism in some children. And as you and the parties heard in the general causation testimony back in May, really what we have focused on here is a particular presentation of autism called regressive autism. And you'll hear testimony from Mr. and Mrs. Dwyer, you'll hear testimony from Dr. Mumper, and you've seen evidence in the medical record that petitioners will maintain demonstrates that Colin clearly suffered an autistic regression after a series of thimerosal-containing vaccines, that his regression became apparent at approximately 20 months of age, that up until that point he developed normally, he developed typically, he met his developmental milestones, he presented, and you hear this particularly this morning from Mr. and Mrs. Dwyer, he was a bright-eyed, active, engaged, playful little boy who had gave no sign, no signal, and no symptom that he would regress into autism during his second year of life. That's important evidence because, as you recall, Special Master, it's petitioner's theory of the case here that thimerosal-containing vaccines can trigger a neuroinflammatory process in some particularly susceptible or vulnerable children. It's an inflammatory process that upsets brain function, particularly upsetting brain function by leading to an imbalance of the chemical neurotransmitters that govern how signals are sent in the brain, and that the exposure in a vulnerable child like Colin at a particularly important period of brain development where the brain is both growing, expanding in size, but also pruning and building its architecture for processing and for function. That environmental insult, more likely than not, caused by the mercury and thimerosal, can lead to the type of symptoms that Colin experienced. And if you recall, the general causation theory that petitioners have advanced here, sort of the jumping off point, if you will, for the individual facts in this case, as well as the facts in Jordan King's and William Mead's case, is that thimerosal-containing vaccines belong on the list of possible environmental causes of autistic regression, where one, through differential diagnosis, can rule out the other known causes. And to really break down the testimony and summarize it concisely, I think, that you'll hear over the next 2 days, is that Mr. and Mrs. Dwyer will offer you the fact testimony and the history and the narrative to describe Colin's birth, his development, his progress, then his regression, and then the medical care and the treatment that he has received since he regressed into autism and continuing on to the present day. That's what you'll hear from the Dwyer family. You'll then hear from Dr. Elizabeth Mumper, who you were introduced to and heard extensive testimony from in May. Dr. Mumper, when she testifies tomorrow, will connect her clinical diagnostic impressions of Colin to the general theory of causation, so that in general, as the jumping off point, you have the idea that thimerosal-containing vaccines belong on the list for a differential diagnosis, and Dr. Mumper will take the facts of this case and connect it to that general theory and offer you evidence that more likely than not, in this particular case, Colin's injury was more likely caused by these thimerosal-containing vaccines than anything else. That is, in essence, the case that you're going to hear for the next 2 days. And at the conclusion of the evidence, I'll say it now, and you will certainly hear it at the end of the fact evidence tomorrow and in our closing of the general causation and individual cases at the end of the day tomorrow, that Colin Dwyer, based on the facts in this case, based on the scientific evidence, the reliable scientific evidence, will present a case that satisfies this program's burden on petitioners to show a mechanism of injury that is logical, that is scientifically supported, that has a logical sequence of cause and effect relating the vaccine exposure, in this case the thimerosal exposure, to the injuries that Colin suffered. And at the conclusion of that evidence, the general causation evidence and the case-specific evidence, we will urge you to award compensation for Colin Dwyer under the program established by Congress to help children like this who would occasionally be injured by the administration of vaccines per the pediatric vaccine schedule. He'll be entitled to compensation, and we will urge you to so rule. Thank you.
Mr. Cardell?
Good morning, Special Master. My name is Lynn Riccadella. I'm from the Department of Justice, and I represent the United States in this litigation. I have just very brief opening remarks that are specific to this case because I'm aware of the court's July 3rd order that said that the general causation evidence for Theory 2 is now closed. And it's respondents' understanding that the case before you today, that the evidence you will hear today and tomorrow, concerns specific causation only as it applies to the facts of Colin Dwyer. And that is how respondent will approach this case and present its evidence in this case. Now, one of the most important aspects of my opening remarks, however, is to take the opportunity to specifically address the Dwyer family and to specifically acknowledge them and thank them for graciously allowing their case and Colin's medical condition to serve as the third test case. And I speak on behalf of the entire United States government when I say you have our utmost respect and admiration for the love and dedication that you have shown to Colin. Special Master, from the outset of the autism omnibus proceedings, the government has always advocated for the application of good science to the facts. Throughout these proceedings, we've been stressing the critical importance of reliable and credible scientific evidence. Indeed, reliable and credible scientific evidence is the bedrock of the vaccine program, particularly in causation and fact cases such as this one. We've been asking the court to evaluate the reliability and the credibility of the expert witnesses offered by both parties, and concomitantly, the reliability and the credibility of the evidence presented by those witnesses. Now, as you are very aware, Special Master, in Daubert, the Supreme Court held that evidence is not scientifically reliable if it amounts to nothing more than unsupported speculation or subjective belief. Now, Special Master, I know that you are intimately familiar with Daubert and its progeny, and I will not discuss it further. I just ask that as you listen to the evidence presented in this case, that you let good science carry the most weight. This case has been selected as a test case by the PSC. That is, it's supposed to serve as a paradigm for the majority of other cases that are currently pending before you and the other special masters in the omnibus. The evidence that petitioners will offer in this case, however, is nothing but unproven hypotheses based on unreliable data. And the speculative nature of petitioner's evidence is borne out by the expert report of Dr. Mumper. In a nutshell, she has postulated that Colin Dwyer suffers from oxidative stress, mercury efflux disorder, neuroinflammation, methylation abnormalities, and an inability to detoxify thimerosal. The majority of these hypotheses are based on her interpretation of laboratory results. Now, mind you, Dr. Mumper is a pediatrician. As she did in the Mead and the King cases, she once again offers a plethora of hypotheses that cover many medical disciplines outside of her own. But in any event, you've already heard evidence presented during the May trial that discounts and disproves each of the hypotheses that you will hear again in this case. In contrast, respondent will present evidence from one witness who is an expert in autism spectrum disorders. We will present testimony from Dr. Bennett Leventhal, who is a tenured professor of psychiatry and the director of the Center for Child Mental Health and Developmental Neuroscience at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Dr. Leventhal has over 30 years of experience diagnosing, treating, and researching autism. He will tell you that there is nothing unique or unusual about Colin's medical condition and Colin's clinical course, including the timing of symptoms and the symptoms themselves, than what he sees in the autistic children in his own practice. Now, I'll end, Special Master, and ask you once again that as you consider the evidence presented in this case over the next 2 days, you let reliable, credible science be your guide, not speculation. Thank you.
Petitioners?
Thank you, Special Master. Mr. Farrell will be approaching the podium and will be presenting our witnesses today.
You call Marie Dwyer.
Mrs. Dwyer, if you'd step up to the witness chair, and when you get there, would you raise your right hand? You swear or affirm that the evidence you shall give in the case now in hearing shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God.
I do.
Thank you.
Would you please state your name for the record?
Maria Dwyer.
And just so we have a clean record, would you spell your name?
Sure. M-A-R-I-A-D-W-Y-E-R.
Maria, tell the court where you were born.
I was born in Queens, New York.
And where did you go to high school?
I went to Monsignor Scanlon High School in the Bronx.
And when did you graduate from high school?
In 1983.
Did you pursue some post-high school education?
I attended St. John's University.
Did you graduate from St. John's University?
Yes, I did.
What type of degree did you obtain?
I have a BA degree in Communication Arts and Sciences.
After college, where did you go to work?
I went to work at NBC Radio.
And what did you do there?
I was a desk assistant in the newsroom.
And after NBC Radio, where did you go to work?
I joined MTV Networks.
How long were you at MTV Networks?
I was there for 12 years.
At some time, you met your current husband. Can you tell me his name?
His name is Timothy Dwyer.
All right. And just so the record's clear, can you spell his first name for us?
Sure. It's T-I-M-O-T-H-Y.
When did you meet Timothy?
Met Timothy in 1992.
And how long did you guys date before you got married?
3 years.
And when were you married?
We were married in April of 1995.
All right. Tell me about that day.
Our wedding day?
Yes.
We got married in Manhattan at a very, very small church. We had a double-decker bus that then took everyone over to one of the oldest and most beautiful old hotels in New York City, and we had our wedding reception there with our family and friends.
After getting married and prior to, we're here to talk about your son, Colin, correct?
Correct.
You had a child after your first marriage. Can you tell me about the name of that child?
Well, my first marriage was, my only marriage was to Timothy. And
right.
My first son was born in June of 1997.
And what is that child's name?
His name is Shane.
All right. And how old is Shane now?
Shane is 11.
Tell me about Shane, just about where he's going to school and what he's doing and how he's doing.
Shane just completed fifth grade. He attends a parochial school in Bayside, Queens called Sacred Heart, and he has been a student there since nursery school. He started there at age three, and he loves it. It's a wonderful school. He has excelled there. At the end of this season, he actually, for the first time, made the honor roll. His average this year has been an A, and it's been a wonderful, wonderful experience for him.
Is Shane involved in any extracurricular activities or any sports outside of the classroom?
Yes, Shane takes gymnastics, and Shane is a runner on a track and field team from another parish near ours called St. Kevin's, and he's the number one runner on the team.
Has Shane ever been diagnosed with any type of developmental disorder?
No.
Has he ever been diagnosed with PDD?
No.
Has he ever been diagnosed with autism?
No.
Has he met all of his developmental milestones?
Yes.
I think we have some pictures of your family, and we want to put those up just so you can identify everybody for the court.
Folks, are we going to make this a trial exhibit, these pictures?
Sure.
And so this would be petitioner's trial exhibit one?
One. Okay, can you identify the first picture and who that is there?
Yes, that is Colin in the middle, and he's on a class trip at a bowling alley. And the young lady behind him was his one-to-one teacher, and her name is Jay Cherie Patel. And the gentleman to the right of Colin, his name was Andy, and he was also an assistant in the classroom in the McCartan School that he was attending at that time.
About how old is Colin in this picture?
He's five.
Can we go to the next picture? Can you identify this picture?
Yes. That's Colin riding on a bus in New York City, and he's eating an apple, and he's listening to his iPod.
Right. How about how old is Colin in this photo?
He's also five.
Can we go to the next photo? Can you identify this photo?
Yes, that's Colin hanging around in a park near our home.
About how old is he in this photo?
He's 8 years old there.
Go to the next photo. Who do we see in this photo?
That is my older son, Shane, and that is Colin in the orange stripes, and that's my husband, Tim.
All right. You mentioned Tim earlier. Was this also his first marriage with you?
Yes.
How was Tim employed?
Tim was employed as a New York City firefighter.
And how long do you know when he started being a firefighter?
He joined the fire department in 1987.
Is Tim still employed with the New York City Fire Department?
No, he's not.
Why isn't he?
He is retired.
Why did he choose to retire?
He retired because he needed to manage Colin's program at home. I had gone back to work. I was working full-time at the time of his retirement, and we decided that we needed to have one parent who was going to be with Colin on a full-time basis to manage him and manage his therapy and his programs and his education.
I think we have one more photo, or is that it?
Just one. How old was Colin in that photo?
He was 8 years old there.
And has Colin done any modeling?
No.
How old is he in this photo?
He's six there.
Is that the last one?
Mm-hmm.
I want to go back and talk to you a little bit about the time period leading up to Colin's birth. At the time Colin was born, about how old was his brother?
He was 17 months.
All right. Tell me about Colin's pregnancy or your pregnancy with Colin.
It was very uneventful. We were very, very happy to conceive a second baby. We wanted to have a second child, and having just gone through a pregnancy with our first child, it was much less stressful. We knew what to expect. We were very excited, and it was a very uneventful period. There were no complications. There were no issues. I worked full-time throughout the entire pregnancy, and it was just very easy.
Did you take any type of drugs, illegal drugs, during your pregnancy?
No.
Did you take any type of prescription drugs during your pregnancy?
Just prenatal vitamins.
Did you smoke during your pregnancy?
No.
Does your husband smoke?
No.
Has he ever smoked?
No.
Was anybody smoking around the child during your pregnancy or around you during your pregnancy?
No.
Did you go to smoky areas during your pregnancy?
No.
Tell me about the few days leading up to Colin's birth and how he was delivered.
Because my first son was delivered naturally and weighed 10 pounds at birth, my obstetrician was concerned about another large baby, and so we agreed that I would be induced at 38 weeks. And so it was a scheduled inducement on November 10th, and we entered the hospital that morning. I was given Pitocin and an epidural. After about 5 hours, I was ready to deliver, and Colin was delivered at 5:30 p.m.
Was there any fetal distress in the hours or days leading up to his birth, Colin's birth?
No.
Was there any distress on your part leading up to Colin's birth?
No.
How long were you in labor?
About 5 hours.
And it was not a C-section, it was a normal delivery?
Yes.
Tell me about Colin after he was born.
Right after Colin was born, he was amazingly alert. Just moments after his birth, he opened his eyes, he looked around the room, he smiled a little bit, he was very responsive, he was very beautiful, he weighed 7 pounds, 14 ounces, he was a perfectly healthy little bundle of joy.
Do you recall, and we have the medical records and evidence, but do you recall his Apgar scores at birth?
It was 9 out of 9.
Was your husband present at the birth?
Yes.
What was his reaction?
Well, having been a New York City firefighter and a New York City police officer and having delivered several babies in his career, he was very cool and calm and collected and really assisted in the birth in a very big way.
I want to go back and ask you a question real quick in terms of your family history and your husband's family history. Do your side of the family, whether it be sisters, cousins, parents, grandparents, is there any history of autism or PDD on your side of the family?
No.
Okay. In terms of your husband's family, is there any, I'm going backwards and forwards in terms of current cousins of Colin's, is there any history or any events in his family of autism or PDD?
No.
Can you tell me about Colin's first year of life in terms of his communication skills and things you did with him?
Mm-hmm. Colin was a very good baby. He very much followed in the same footsteps as our older son. He was a very good eater. He was a good sleeper. At 3 months, he sat up on his own. At 6 months, he was pulling himself up. And at 9 months, he started to walk. And by 12 months, he was a great walker. He was a very happy baby. He loved to be held. If you smiled at him, he would reciprocate the smile. He made a lot of babbling noises. He was developing language. He loved to watch TV, and he loved to be around other babies.
What type of TV programs would he watch?
He loved to watch Blue's Clues on Nickelodeon, and he liked to watch Sesame Street. He also liked watching Little Bear, and he liked watching Franklin.
Was the company you were working for involved in developing some of these programs?
Yes, it was.
What type of programs did your company develop?
At the time, I was working at Nickelodeon. So we developed Blue's Clues, Little Bear, Franklin, Dora the Explorer, Jimmy Neutron, Rugrats.
When he watched these type of programs, would Colin laugh or giggle appropriately while he was watching the programs?
Yes, he would.
All right. Tell me about, and just during his first year of life, I guess Colin was born. Can you tell me his birth date again?
Sure. 11-10-98.
Okay. So he was kind of an early Christmas present.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me, up until his second Christmas, where he would have been a little over 1 year old, tell me about Colin's social skills in terms of interacting with you and your husband and his older brother.
He was very responsive to people. As he started to be able to walk, when I would come home from work at night, he would run right to the door to greet me, hold on to my leg. Sometimes in the morning, he and his older brother would hold on to my legs, not wanting me to leave. And a lot of times, my husband would bring them to the railroad station where I would come home from work, and they would see me getting off the train, and they would see me walking up the steps, and they would get very excited. He loved to be in a stroller. He loved to be outside. He loved going to stores. He loved toys. He could walk around a toy store and pick a particular toy he was interested in. He liked playing with toys. He particularly liked blocks. He liked building with blocks. And he loved stuffed animals.
In terms of, tell me about what he did with the toys he played with. Again, in his first year of life, what types of things would he make and what specific types of toys would he play with?
He liked when you would build something with blocks and then he could knock it down. He liked doing that. And he liked little bowling games where he could roll a ball and knock down pins. He liked that. He liked to hug stuffed animals, and he liked to look at them in their faces, and he would talk to them and play with them. He liked toys that talked, that if you squeeze them, they would say a few words. He had a little bear that would talk, and he loved that very much.
Did he enjoy playing the drums?
Oh, yes. He was a big drummer. He loved playing the drums. He not only liked playing the toy drums, but he liked taking out pots and pans and playing them with utensils.
Is that something he would do with his brother?
Yes.
What other type of activities would Colin do with his older brother during his first year of life?
Well, they were always together. They slept in the same room. Sometimes they would sleep in the same crib. They napped together. They ate together. They took baths together. They were always side by side, and he liked him very, very much. He smiled when he was near him. He would touch him. He liked sitting next to him in the stroller. And he would watch him. He would watch him and oftentimes take a toy out of his hand that he saw that he wanted. And they had a nice rapport and a nice interaction.
Where do your parents live?
Queens.
When you would visit your parents or they would visit you during his first year of life, was Colin able to identify his grandparents and was he happy to see them?
Oh, definitely. Very, very happy. He had grandparents, both my parents and my husband's parents, and he got very excited whenever we went to either one's house.
All right. I want to talk to you a little bit about Colin's progression from his first year. Wait, let me back up a little bit. Tell me about his second Christmas when Colin was a little over 1 year old. Tell me about the things you did at Colin's second Christmas.
By then, Colin was 13 months old, and he was a typical baby who was all over the place. He was walking very, very well then, and he was climbing up stairs. And he had a love of Christmas ornaments and Christmas trees. And when we went to visit my in-laws, he started removing Christmas ornaments from the tree and Christmas decorations my mother-in-law had around the house. And he was digging into things he wasn't supposed to. And he was just a very little precocious little baby. And you had to watch him very carefully because he was into everything.
Was he able to open his own presents, and did he receive joy from opening his presents at that second Christmas?
Oh, he sure did. He got a lot of presents. He ripped off the paper. He played with the paper a little bit. He liked the paper, but then he also, you know, liked the toys.
What type of toys do you remember that Colin got for his second Christmas? Do you remember any of them?
He got cars and boats and balls, kind of real typical boy toys.
Right, I want to move ahead now and talk about Colin's development from the first Christmas or from 12 months, 13 months of age until he was 20 months of age. How did his communication and language skills in terms of developing words develop?
He had a lot of babble, and then he started to form words. He said mama and dada, and he said baba for his bottle. He said bye-bye. That was a big one. And that was maybe his first or second word, and he also had a wave. He could wave bye-bye. He said baby. He said bear. He said up. And he had a lot of pointing and gesturing, and he would pull you to, if he didn't have the language, he would pull you, say, over to the TV set if he wanted you to put the television on or put a tape on.
What if he wanted a cookie?
He could say cookie.
Was that one of his favorite foods?
Yes, it was.
All right. Tell me, and again, in the same time frame, from Colin's 12 months to 20 months, in terms of his social skills and interacting with his brother and relatives and you and your husband.
Well, you know, he just continued to flourish. He was able to play catch and a little bit more structured play activities. He very much liked roughhousing, and he liked rolling and tumbling. And at the time, we put a set of bunk beds into his room, and both he and his brother would jump off the top of the bunk beds, and we would put pillows on the bottom, and that was an activity they loved. They loved jumping on the bed. They loved jumping on all sorts of furniture. They like swinging. They like climbing. And, you know, they continued to develop side by side. They did a lot of play activities at the park. They were real outdoors kids. We had baby seats on the back of our bikes, and we would take them for rides, and they loved that. They loved motion. They loved trains. Loved movement.
Did Colin have any sensitivities up until 20 months? Did he have any sensitivities to noises or loud noises?
No.
Did he have any obsessive-compulsive behaviors that you noticed, whether it be lining up objects or anything of that nature?
No.
How was his general temperament during his first 20 months of life?
He was a very easygoing baby.
If he did become upset, were you able to console him?
Oh, yes. You could pick him up, and he loved his binky, and he loved his bottle, and he loved to be held, and he was very consolable.
Okay. Tell the court how you structured your career with your husband's career, and how, during the first 20 months of Colin's life, how you handled the child care.
Well, I was working at the time at MTV Networks. My hours were essentially 9 to 6. I did have some travel involved. It was standard business hours. And Tim was working as a firefighter. And within the fire department, there's more flexibility with schedules. You can trade off tours with other firefighters. And so Tim was able to structure his work schedule so that he worked primarily evenings and weekends. And so he was the primary caretaker of the kids during the day, and then I was on the night at night and on the weekends.
I want to turn to Colin's development after the 20-month period now. And I guess we would be in the fall of 2000, is that right?
Yes.
Did you notice any change in Colin's language and communication skills during the fall of 2000?
He wasn't using his language as much. He wasn't babbling as much. We started to notice changes in him around the fall.
What type of changes did you notice?
It was really initially it was behavioral changes. It was he just suddenly did not want to sit in his stroller. He did not want to go out of the house. He became extremely upset when we went to places that previously he enjoyed. He would scream and cry, and he was difficult to pick up. And he did not use his language the way he had been using it previously.
Did bath times change from pre-20 months to after 20 months?
Yes, he always loved his bath time. And after 20 months, he refused to take a bath. It was a very, very difficult process to get him to take a bath. He completely rejected it.
Tell me about Christmas, Colin's third Christmas, where he was, I guess he would have been 25 months old. What was that like?
Well, every year on Christmas, we go to my in-law's house, and my mother-in-law has a big, big party with lots of people and kids. And we just didn't think that that would be right for Colin. He just didn't seem to enjoy those activities. And so we decided to stay home. And we had my parents and my sister and a close friend who came. And we were going to have a little small party. And Colin was, he was very sick and sad and unhappy. And we had a Rubbermaid bin that we had some decorations in that was in the living room. And Tim put some pillows and some blankets inside the bin. And he sat in there the whole time on Christmas. And he never opened a present. He never acknowledged the other folks that were there. He just was completely docile.
Moving into the spring of 01, can you tell me, in terms of Colin's language ability, what type of words, if any, could he speak in the spring of 01?
He wasn't using any words in the spring of 01.
So the specific words that he had a command of, he had lost?
Yes.
Tell me, and again, in the spring of 01, about Colin's social skills and interacting with you and your husband and the relatives he previously knew and his brother.
He just was not comfortable in large groups. He did not like people. If my other son approached him and even got within a few feet of him, he would scream at the top of his lungs. He did not like to be touched. He did not like to be held. He did not like to wear clothes. He was extremely agitated, and he stopped eating. He lost weight. He developed diarrhea. He just would go to the park and would not want to participate in park activities. He just likes sitting alone in the corner.
Did you guys, where do you and your husband live?
We live in Bayside, New York.
Right. And did you have a park near your house?
We did.
And is that something that you did on a frequent basis prior to these problems developing?
Oh, he was there every day.
At some point, did you become concerned in terms of seeking out some medical attention or care for Colin?
We did.
Tell me how that came about.
In March of 2001, we went to our pediatrician's office, who we had been working with since the birth of Shane, and we explained to her that we were concerned about some of these issues, and she referred us immediately for a speech and language evaluation. First, for her greatest concern was his lack of language and the loss of language. And so she immediately referred us for an audiologist evaluation to test his hearing and said if his hearing turns out to be fine, then she referred us for a speech and language evaluation.
Right. Who did you go to the what all audiologist did you go to?
Dr. Goldstein.
All right. And how did that visit go?
Colin was very difficult and was really unable to complete the testing.
Okay. How did you progress with Colin's evaluation after that point?
Well, Dr. Goldstein said, although the test results were inconclusive, it was his professional opinion that he did not have any hearing loss. He did not believe that. So from there, we scheduled a speech and language evaluation.
And who did you do that with?
We did it with a special ed preschool program in Queens called TIPSY.
And what was the results of that visit?
They evaluated Colin not only for his speech and language, but for his behavioral and his social. And they informed us that he was profoundly, severely, developmentally delayed.
All right. And do you recall approximately what month that was?
That was in May of 2001.
How did you proceed with Colin's care after that point?
After that, we took him to a neurologist at NYU Medical Center to concur the diagnosis, which he did.
Right. And then, do you recall his name?
His name was Dr. Irving Fish.
Right. And tell us specifically what Dr. Fish told you.
Dr. Fish said that based on what he had read from the evaluation at TIPSY and his own evaluation of Colin, that he was seriously, seriously delayed, and his diagnosis was autism. And he said it was moderate to severe.
Did you communicate with Dr. Fish about Collins' prior development in his early life prior to 20 months
yes.
in his development? What did he tell you about that?
He said he was seeing many, many, many more cases like this, and that we needed to move very, very quickly and begin interventions with him. And he was not very optimistic about his long-term outcome.
All right. So after seeing Dr. Fish, where did you go with Colin, or what was the next step in his treatment?
Well, then we went back to the group, the organization, TIPSI, that had evaluated him. They also had a school that they ran. And first we met with social workers from the city of New York, and he was approved admittance into the TIPSI program.
And what does TIPSI stand for, if you know?
It's Toddler and Infant Special Ed Preschool.
All right.
And it focused on the all the children who attended it were on the autistic spectrum.
All right. And, again, can you give us a time frame for this?
Yes. He started TIPSI in June of 2001.
All right. And how long was he involved in TIPSI?
He was there until December of 2001.
Tell us, during this time period, let's go back and let's talk about Colin's communication skills. From the time period you just mentioned, in the late summer, fall, and early winter of 2001, what were Colin's communication skills?
Colin had no words at that point, so we started him with an aggressive speech therapy program, and he was simply learning to imitate sounds. That was the goal that they were working on.
What about his social reciprocity skills?
He still extremely disliked being around people. He was a just profoundly unhappy person unless he was allowed to sit in the corner and play with toys in his own way. He didn't want any interaction with adults, children. He didn't want the outside world. He didn't want toys, store. He didn't want birthday parties. He didn't want any of the things that he had liked earlier in life.
Did he exhibit any characteristics of sorting or lining characteristics during that time period?
Yes, he did.
Tell me about that.
He would take his blocks and he would sort them by color and then by size, and he would line them. And he'd become very, very obsessed and upset if the line didn't somehow meet the criteria he had set up for it. It was very hard to determine what that was. He began lining excessively all over the house, any items. He liked anything in multiples, including food items. One morning he got up in the middle of the night and he took a dozen eggs out of the refrigerator and he lined them from the length of our kitchen all the way, you know, into our dining room.
Prior in Colin's, let's say, eight-month, 20-month period, how would he play with his blocks?
He would build. He could build. He could build little structures, and then he would knock them down and laugh. And if you attempted to build, he would get extremely, extremely upset.
When you attempt, what during what time period are you talking about if you attempted to build?
This was in 2001.
All right. Tell us about, from TIPSI, were you pleased with the result in TIPSI?
No.
Okay. Why not?
Well, it was a preschool. It had a lot of students. It wasn't extremely intensive. And he didn't seem to make a lot of progress there.
At this point, did Colin have any aversion in terms of clothing or diapers or things that you were trying to dress him in?
Yes.
Tell me about that.
He just suddenly did not like to wear clothes, and getting him dressed was an enormous feat. He would not like to put shirts on. He didn't want to wear pants. We had to switch his clothes to shorts, and he could tolerate that a little bit better. He did not like to wear shoes. You had to really, really wrestle with him to get his shoes on, and he would take them off. And as soon as he came home, he would strip, and he would like to be naked in the house as much as he could.
Did Colin at some point start to develop self-injurious behavior?
Yes, he did.
When was that?
That was in 2001.
Right. What type of things would he do?
He would bang his head on the wall very hard. He was just smashing his head. He would also punch himself in the head.
So is that one of the reasons you felt he might need a more intensive therapy program?
Yes.
Where did you go from Tipsy?
From Tipsy, in December, we went for a consultation with Dr. C.C. McCartan, who was recommended to us as a developmental pediatrician in New York City, who specialized in children with autistic spectrum disorders. And so we took Colin to her in December of 01, and she advised us to take Colin immediately out of Tipsy and start a 40-hour-a-week home program with him where he could get intensive therapy and speech therapy, occupational therapy, physical therapy, and ABA in the home.
Did you follow her advice?
We did.
All right. And how long did that progress?
We did our home program for the entire year of 2001. It was a 40-hour-a-week program, plus we supplemented it with additional services in the center that Dr. McCartan ran in Manhattan. So he had a 40-hour-a-week program in the home, and then he was also going to the McCartan Center 4 days a week for additional speech and OT.
What was the cost of this program?
The therapy at the McCartan Center, it costs $100 an hour.
So how much a week were you spending on your son at that time?
Well, at that time in 2001, the home-based therapy was provided by the state of New York. So we were just paying for the 4 hours a week that he was attending the McCartan Center.
And at some point, did you progress? Did the home-based program help?
No.
All right. Where did you progress to after that point?
Well, we went, Dr. McCartan came out to our home and observed the program, and Colin was then reevaluated, and he had not made progress, and she was very, very upset, and she told us that we could not continue this home program and that we had to look for another alternative for him. At the time, she had just opened a school, but there were no slots available, so we decided to place him in her center for 40 hours a week, beginning in January of 2002.
Okay. And did you and your husband go and personally observe the therapy that Colin was getting at this center?
Yes, we did.
All right. Did they have an open door policy where you guys could walk in at any time and observe what was going on with Colin?
Yes, they did.
Tell me about the type of therapy and treatment that Colin got at the center.
At the center, Colin had a very intensive ABA program with speech therapy and occupational therapy. There was some community-based therapy as well, but it was primarily focused on managing his problem behaviors and working through contingency plans that involved the LOVOS methodology with lots of positive reinforcement.
Okay. What is that? You said the ABA?
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about what that involves.
Well, ABA stands for Applied Behavioral Analysis, and it's a scientifically proven methodology for working with children with autism. It was developed by Ivar Lovas in the 60s, and certain autism programs embrace that methodology for their programs. And we had been advised, and we had done research on our own, and we very much embraced the LOVOS and methodology, and we wanted Colin to be put in a program where he would be receiving that type of intervention.
What was the cost of the McCartney Center when you were sending Colin there for that period of time?
The cost was $100 per hour for therapy, and Colin was there 40 hours per week.
So how much a week was the cost of the therapy?
$4,000.
And how many weeks was he in therapy for?
Oh, he was there for over 12 weeks.
Where did Colin progress after the therapy sessions you've been talking about?
In March then of 2003, he then was accepted into the McCartan School.
Okay. And what is the McCartan School?
The McCartan School is an ABA-based program for children with autistic spectrum disorder. It provides a one-to-one student-teacher ratio with an individualized curriculum and then home-based contingency support.
Tell us about how long he was in the actual school.
Colin joined the McCartan School in March of 2003, and he remained there until August of 2006.
Did did you see, it's a long period of time, did you see an improvement? And tell us about the improvement, if you did see some with Colin during that time period.
We definitely saw an improvement during that time period. Colin benefited greatly from the intensive speech therapy he received.
Did Colin develop some speech?
Yes.
Did some speech come back? Tell me about that.
He did. They worked very intensively, and he went really just from being able to mimic sounds to being able to put together small words. And he had, I'd say, 50 or 60 single word utterances during the first 2 or 3 years at the McCartan School. His language definitely was improving. His behaviors, they worked very intensively on an eating program, on a dressing program, and on a walking program. Colin had enormous, enormous difficulty walking appropriately.
How much was the cost of the school?
The tuition at the school is $90,000.
Per
year.
How did you and your husband afford to pay for that?
We liquidated our savings. We refinanced the mortgage on our home. And my salary goes 100% towards support of his education.
I want to back up a little bit and take you back to the time period after Colin's diagnosis. You talked about a little bit of quite a bit about his educational progression. Let's talk about, did you also seek some medical interventions as you were advised to do?
Yes.
All right. What was the first major medical intervention that you sought for Colin?
We made an appointment to see Dr. Bach, who was a practicing DAN doctor. We had found out about the DAN protocol from some other parents, and we were referred to Dr. Bach. So we went to visit with him, and he immediately wanted to start biomedical interventions based on the DAN protocol with Colin.
All right. And what type of interventions did Dr. Bach conduct?
Well, the very first intervention that we worked on was trying to deal with Colin's chronic diarrhea and weight loss and lack of weight gain or growth in a year. And Dr. Bach felt that Colin had had gut issues and gut damage, and we did a food allergy panel, and it turned out that Colin was highly allergic to virtually every food group. So we started him on a very strict gluten-free, casein-free diet, and we also began supplementation. He was taking about 15 different supplements, including digestive enzymes, to help him have more formed bowel movements.
Did Dr. Bach do any testing on Colin?
He did.
What type of testing did he do?
He did a lot of blood work on him. Initially, it was just really focusing on treating his gut. And then later we moved on to other interventions.
What type of interventions did you conduct?
Well, after Dr. Bach felt that his gut was in a better place and we saw dramatic improvement in his stool and his bowel movement, and his stomach had been distended and actually stopped being distended, his eyes got, he had circles under his eyes that they lightened up. We definitely saw his physical appearance improving. Dr. Bach then wanted to move on and aggressively chelate him.
And can you tell us about the chelation process and the results of the chelation?
Well, the chelation process is designed to eliminate toxins and heavy metals specifically from a person's body. And the intervention that we used was two drugs. One was DMSA and the other was ALA. And Dr. Bach had told us that these were both FDA-approved drugs that had been in existence since the 50s and had been very effective in chelating people with heavy metal exposure.
What was the results of Colin's chelation in terms of mercury exposure?
Well, prior to starting the DMSA and ALA, we took a urine sample, which was pre-provocative, just to assess what his levels were prior to provoking him with the drugs. And when we got those test results back, he basically showed that his metals that he had were in reference range. They were in the normal reference range. In fact, he didn't present as having any mercury at all. 2 days later, then we provoked him with the DMSA and the ALA, and we collected a second urine sample. And when we got the test results for that, we saw that his level of mercury was all the way off the sheet.
After the chelation, what was the next intervention you attempted with Colin?
After that, we did glutathione infusions.
What is that?
Glutathione is also a very potent antioxidant, and it's a chelator, and it helps detoxify. And we did about 30 IV infusions of glutathione.
All right. And did that help?
No.
What did you do next?
We did methylcobalamin. We did 50 methylcobalamin shots.
All right. And did that work? Or did it improve his condition, Colin's condition?
Very minimally.
Subsequently, after Dr. Bach, did you move on and see someone else?
We did.
Who was that?
We moved on to see Dr. Russell, and he runs the Northern New York Autism Clinic.
All right. And what did you do with Dr. Russell?
Dr. Russell implemented...
Can you give us a general time frame? I'm sorry.
Sure. Well, we started with Dr. Bach in April of 2002. And after 2 years, actually it was a little more than 2 years, it was June of 2004, we spoke with Dr. Bach about the fact that we felt that we had basically utilized every intervention under the DAN protocol that was really available at that time. And we were generally very happy with the interventions because although we didn't see any dramatic result after one particular intervention, Colin was continuing to progress nicely in development and language acquisition and improvement in his problem behaviors. So we sort of felt that we wanted to take another turn and look at some other type of intervention. So we researched the NIDS protocol, which a lot of people who implement the DAN protocol do as sort of a next step. And that protocol focuses on viral issues, fungal issues in the gut, and it also prescribes an SSRI, anti-anxiety drug. And we tried those interventions next.
Did they improve?
They did.
Okay. Did you ultimately put Colin on an SSRI drug?
Yes.
Is that something you and your husband wanted to do?
Absolutely not.
Why not?
These drugs are not approved for long-time usage in children. They're not approved for any usage in children. There's no studies that implicate what the long-term damage could be. These are very, very powerful, dangerous drugs, and we did not want to subject a child to any possible further damage.
Has the SSRI drug helped with Colin?
It has.
I want to go back. Has Colin ever, to your knowledge, been evaluated for any comorbid factor of mental retardation?
Not formally, no.
Okay. Was there an informal evaluation of Colin that you can tell us about in terms of any comorbid factor of mental retardation?
There was an incident when he was at the McCartan School where they were implementing a program with all the children, and it was called PECS.
And who was running this program again?
It was Dr. Ivy Feldman, who was the executive director of the McCartan School.
All right. And what are her credentials?
She's a PhD psychologist.
All right.
And they were starting a program called PECS, which is the Picture Exchange Communication System. And what it really is comprised of is, because children with autism are such strong visual learners, it actually provides each child with an individualized set of very small pictures that they can use to articulate their needs and their wants. And they were setting up these small books that each child would have with them. And in Colin's case, if Colin was to perform a task, which he was going to be reinforced for, he would be asked what he would like to work for his reinforcement. He could open his PECS book, and he could look at his icons, and he might have a drum or a guitar or a stuffed animal, and he could actually take the icon out and give it to the teacher to communicate what his desired object was. And it's been scientifically proven to be a highly effective communication vehicle for children with autism who have high receptive language but have extreme difficulty with expressive language. And at the time I was observing, and I saw all the children in the room were working on their PECS books with the exception of one student. and I asked Dr. Feldman why that one child didn't have a PECS book. And she said that when they were evaluating the children for the PECS program, they found that in this particular student's case, she was not able to discriminate photos appropriately. So if you asked her to give you an icon of any object, a desired object, she was unable to do that. And she commented to me that it's at times like this that we then discover that some of these children also have a second diagnosis, which is mental retardation. And it's very hard for the parents because they're not expecting to hear this, because the kids are a little bit older at this point, and it's a real blow to the parents. And I said, do you think that Colin also has this? And she said, absolutely not. He's a very fast learner, and we are very pleased with his progress, and he absolutely has embraced PECS and is using it very successfully. And that would be an indicator for us.
Of all the doctors that you've seen with Colin over the last 9 years, have any of them ever suggested to you that Colin might be suffering from any form, mild, moderate, or severe, of mental retardation?
No. In fact, the opposite. People constantly tell us how extremely bright he is. And although he has severe limitations, he does learn very quickly. He problem solves extremely well, and we were told that from a very early age. And people have told us that for a child with autism, he displays a lot of intelligence.
Tell me about sitting here today or at this time. What is Colin's functioning level in terms of, can you go to a restaurant with him and sit down and eat dinner?
No.
Just describe his functioning level just a little bit for the court.
Sure. You know, we still continue to have to attack the behaviors very aggressively and on a daily basis. You know, going into, Colin just exhibits extreme levels of rigidity and obsessive compulsive behavior. So he is very, very self-directed. And if there's an activity that he enjoys, he can participate in that, but it is very, very difficult still to get him to participate in an activity that he's not interested in. So going to, you know, a restaurant in Applebee's or TGI Fridays, he will still fall on the floor. He'll scream. He will try to run out the door. He will run around the restaurant. He might throw a chair. He can get aggressive behaviorally. He could still hit himself. And he would be very, very difficult to manage or control.
And you mentioned that, have you bonded with some other families with similar autistic children?
Yes.
Can you compare, in terms of improvements, you mentioned Colin had regained some speech, and you've obviously done a lot of different things in terms of medical and educational benefits to Colin. Can you compare his progress with some of the other children who have not had those benefits?
Well, when Colin first joined the McCartan School in 2003, he was in a classroom with three other little boys, and we're still in contact with those families. And they didn't as aggressively embrace the biomedical side of autism treatment as we did. And although at that time all four boys were just similar in the sense that none of them had language, and all of them had behavioral problems and sensory integration issues and eating issues. Today, Colin's functionality, just in comparison to those other three children, is a little bit higher.
Can you tell me about your husband's decision to retire from the New York City Fire Department and why he did that and his role in Colin's treatment over the last 4 or 5 years?
He has always been an extremely hands-on father from birth and has always enjoyed changing diapers and pushing them in their carriage and taking them to stores and taking them all over the place, parties and firehouses and everywhere. And at the time, I had left my job in 2001.
Why did you do that?
I did that to manage Colin's program on a full-time basis.
Okay.
You know, we found after we got our diagnosis that there really was no recommended course of treatment, and parents are really left to their own devices to have to figure out how you want to treat your child's autism. And it takes, you know, an extraordinary amount of time to network with other parents and do the outreach and contact doctors and have evaluations done. And it requires a full-time commitment to managing a child's program with autism. So I was doing that, and then he was in his 20th year, and he was eligible for retirement. He did not want to retire because he really loved his job, but we decided at that point that he would retire and take over as the full-time caregiver for Colin, and then I would return to work.
I don't think I have anything for you at this time. The government may have a few questions, and we'll talk later. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Johnson?
Good morning, Mrs. Dwyer. My name is Beau Johnson, and I'm representing the United States, and I have really just a couple of questions for you. You've submitted an affidavit in this case, so you're aware of that, I guess.
Yes.
I assume that affidavit, you provided information to your attorney and they actually prepared the actual document. Is that correct?
Yes.
Do you recall when you provided that information to your attorney?
Sometime in June.
Okay. And the affidavit, I noticed, is dated July 15th. Was that the day that you actually saw the affidavit, or had you seen it before that?
Oh, I had seen it before that.
Okay. When did you first see it?
I saw it sometime in June. I was in possession of it for a couple of weeks before I actually was able to have it signed and notarized.
And the information that's in the affidavit, how did you go about getting that information? Did you review any documents, or was it just based on memory?
No, I have complete records of Colin's medical files and all of his evaluations, and I have a very strong memory of it all.
Okay. And in preparation for your testimony today, did you do anything other than what you did you review anything other than what you reviewed for preparing your affidavit?
No.
When did you first begin to think that Colin's autism was caused by vaccines?
After Colin had his last round of vaccinations, which was in July of 2000, he started his gradual regression shortly thereafter, and it then continued into 2001.
So it was based on the timing, and that's what caused you to suspect mm-hmm. the vaccines were contributing to it?
Yes.
Okay. Great, thank you. Nothing further.
Okay.
I may have a couple of questions for you. Let me just look at my notes here. Mrs. Dwyer, based on my review of the medical records, it appears that Colin received 4 hepatitis B vaccines rather than the usual 3. Do you know, have you reviewed his hospital records?
Yes.
His newborn records?
Mm-hmm.
And did he receive a hepatitis B vaccine?
At birth?
At birth.
I believe so.
And then according to his medical records, it appears he received 1 when he was about 2 weeks old. And then he got 2 more thereafter.
Mm-hmm.
Is that your understanding?
That's my belief, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So it's sometimes we see that children were supposed to have a newborn vaccination and didn't get it. Sometimes the records are inconclusive. But as far as you're concerned, he got one at birth.
Yes,
or shortly thereafter.
That's what I believe.
Okay. You described several of the people who evaluated Colin that he did not appear to be making some of his developmental milestones at the same age as his older brother. And with the 2 children fairly close together, you'd have a pretty good memory of that.
Mm-hmm.
Do you recall specifically what things he was doing or not doing that his older brother did at a similar age?
Well, probably after that Christmas of 2001, we became concerned really about the fact that the language was not progressing and flourishing the way we had seen it flourish with our other son, who also, you know, at age 20 months, didn't have an expansive vocabulary, but we saw how his language was developing, and we were seeing how Collins, in fact, not only was not developing, but had regressed. And that was great concern, because that was really the first time we saw the two brothers developing on different paths. Colin had followed Shane's development path identically up until that point, and that started to concern us.
And that was the Christmas when he was being, you put him in the plastic crate.
Right.
Were there anything other than language that concerned you about the behavior differences between the two boys?
We started to see the physical symptoms around that time in the fall.
And by physical symptoms, you're referring to what?
Well, the first thing that was very profound was just his complete rejection of food. He was a good little baby, and he was eating baby food, and he was eating some cereals, and he was eating vegetables, and he was just a good little eater, and we were transitioning him onto whole foods, and he was eating mashed potatoes, and he was eating just pureed food, and he was doing really nicely, and he just absolutely rejected every food that we put in front of him. At the same time, he always had a normal bowels, and he never had any sort of diarrhea, and he just developed chronic diarrhea that it would just leak right down his diaper. And we were just so perplexed because it was so unusual that would happen. And we just tried to focus on that and introduce him to different foods. And it was a real challenge. And then we saw the weight loss. And so it was that combined with the language component that was really worrisome for us. And then we went back to the pediatrician in March of 2001 and told her about these symptoms. And she strongly urged us to get him evaluated immediately. She was really concerned.
You indicated when you were talking about the biomedical interventions that you had Colin on the gluten-free, casein-free diet. And then it appears from some of the medical records that you sort of fell off the gluten part but kept him dairy-free.
Mm-hmm.
And why was that?
Well, his bowels had gotten progressively better. And we wanted to expand his diet because he needed more food. He needed to gain weight. And then when he started at the McCartan School, in the classroom he was in, none of the other students were on the diet. And they were eating cookies, and they were eating breadsticks and pretzels. And he was really interested in those foods. And it's very difficult when other children are eating that and you're eating a carrot stick. And it was a source of behavioral issues for him. And we decided that we were going to take him off the diet and just see what the response would be. And once we did, we actually saw that he flourished once he had wheat back in his diet. And he could have some cookies and he could have some pretzels. And they became good reinforcers for him. And it sort of was a gateway for us then to introduce other foods that he had rejected when he was also allowed to have foods that he liked.
I have no further questions. Mr. Farrell?
Thank you. No, Your Honor, you don't have anything else.
All right. Mrs. Dwyer, you may step down then.
Thank you.
Unless the government has anything follow-up to mine, I'm presuming you didn't. Given the brevity of your original cross-examination. All right. Shall we proceed then with our next witness?
Commissioner will call Mr. Okay. Dwyer.
Mr. Dwyer, if you'd raise your right hand.
Yes, ma'am.
Do you swear or affirm that the evidence you shall give in the case now in hearing shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, son of God?
I do.
Thank you.
Would you please state your full name for the record?
Timothy Patrick Dwyer.
All right. And Mr. Dwyer, where were you born?
I was born in Suffolk, New York.
All right. And what is your date of birth?
7/15/1963.
Where did you go to school?
Northport High School.
And where is that located?
Out in Northport, New York.
And did you receive any college?
I have a 2-year associate degree from Suffolk Community College.
And what is your associate's degree in?
Just general studies, arts and science.
After college, what did you do?
I joined the New York City Police Department.
All right. Why did you make that choice?
Just a career move that I always wanted, and I further wanted to get onto the fire department afterwards, and all the time counted for pension purposes.
All right. How long were you with the New York City Fire Department?
I was with the fire department for 16 years, and I was with the police department for 4 years.
Was your father also a New York City fireman?
Yes, he was.
For how many years was he on the fire department?
He did about 30.
Tell me about meeting Mrs. Dwyer, how you met.
We met down in Rockaway, and immediately fell in love.
Good answer. Tell us about, you were involved in 9/11.
I was.
Can you tell us about what you were doing on that day?
I was working, just coming off a 24-hour shift in Engine 234 in Crown Heights, Brooklyn. And we were out on another job when the towers got hit. So we weren't immediately dispatched. We were very lucky. And I wound up going down in the second wave just after the towers came down.
Did you lose some friends in that event?
I did.
I want to back up a little bit and talk to you about your son and your first son. Were you with him? I'm sorry. Tell me about when your first son was born. How was Maria's pregnancy?
Very, very well. She was a very healthy girl, and she got big, and she had a big, beautiful 10-pound boy. And he was it was a struggle for him to be born. He was so big and came out a little floppy, but bounced back really quick.
Tell me about the Maria's pregnancy when Colin was born.
The same. She was, like I said, she's a very healthy girl, and no problems. It was probably easier than the first pregnancy, sickness-wise. And, you know, again, Colin was born with no complications. In fact,
were you present when he was born?
I was, yeah.
All right, tell me about that.
And, you know, well, he was, like I said, born, the process was much easier than when Shane was born because he was so big. And Colin had a nice delivery. And a few minutes after he was, you know, cleaned up and wrapped, the nurse presented him to me in my arms, and he was looking at me and smiling. And I did something terrible. I asked Maria to take a picture of me while she was still recovering. And I have a picture of Colin looking at me with a big smile on his face. It was an amazing moment.
Tell me, since you spent a lot of time every day with Colin, tell me about his development in terms of his communication skills during his first year of life up until that, I guess it would be his second Christmas, but things you saw in him that maybe Mrs. Dwyer hasn't talked about.
He was very much like his brother. When I, you know, looked at him and smiled at him, he smiled back at me, and when I made noise to him, he'd try and repeat the noises or, you know, at least respond to me in baby talk. Would always reach up for me when he saw me. Loved being tickled. Communication-wise, you know, he had his basic words. He Papa for bottle. He called me Dada, Mommy. He had bye bye. He said up. When I came to him, he always put his arms up and said up. And of course, Cookie was one of his favorites.
Did he get along well with his brother?
Loved him, yeah. Followed him around, tried to emulate his behavior. We were all three of us were always together. We were all over the neighborhood. I had a double stroller. One had like a little step in the back and a seat so my oldest son could sit in the back. And he was up front, and we were road warriors. We were all over Bayside.
How far are you located from the park?
About two blocks.
Is that something you did pretty much during Colin's first year of life?
Basically, every day we'd go to the park, and then I'd swing around. We'd hit all the stores on Bell Boulevard, and we're just always out and about.
Tell me about the specific activities that Colin was capable of doing at the park.
He was a very good climber. They had a nice – it was actually a brand-new park. They had redone it. The time was, like, perfect for us. And they had a beautiful apparatus for climbing and a bridge, a couple of slides – this tunnel thing that Colin loved to go through. And they had like a little piano, very simple, you know, row, row, row your boat kind of thing. And I'd play and he'd always bang on things too. And we had a blast down there.
During Colin's, let's say, first 20 months of life, did he have any aversion to loud noises?
No.
All right. Did you take him to the fire department?
I took him to the firehouse all the time. I love going down there, climbing on the rig, touching everything. I even took him on a couple of runs with the sirens going. He completely loved it, him and Shane. And we had Christmas parties there every year. And I guess when he was one, we took him and sat in Santa's lap and went down the pole. And, you know, we had a great family moment there.
Were fires being dispatched while you were at the Christmas party?
Yeah, the trucks were going in and out all day long. We were a pretty busy company.
Were the sirens on?
Oh, yeah.
Did he have any problem with the noise?
I don't know. The kids loved it. They would clear them all out of the way and watch the rigs go out. And, you know, it was part of the entertainment, really.
All right. I want to talk a little bit about his progression from – tell me about Colin's first Christmas and the things – excuse me, his second Christmas when Colin was basically 13 months old and the things you did at that Christmas party.
We went out to my parents and you know, as Maria had stated earlier, he was just into everything. You know, all the bulbs on the bottom of the tree he was ripping off and playing with. And the house isn't that big, so there was a lot of presents and paper all over the place. And Colin was just reveling in the excitement of the day and the chaos of the presents and paper all over the place, you know.
From 12 to 20 months, what type of toys would Colin play with and what would he do with the toys?
12 to 20 months, he loved his cars, he loved his blocks.
What would he do with the blocks?
You know, I'd help him build things, he'd like to knock them down, or he'd, you know, appropriately play, you know, with his brother with the blocks. I actually had these big the blocks that were made out of cardboard, and, you know, they looked like big bricks, and, you know, we'd build forts down the basement, and, you know, the kids would play in it and knock it over, and, very typical type behavior.
Was Colin happy to see his cousins and his grandparents and other family members during the first 20 months of life?
Yes, he was. He liked being around people. He liked the excitement of a lot of people in the room. He's very close to his brother. He was always following him around. And, you know, even when I took him out to public places and stores and things like that, he just, you know, was very alert looking around and taking it all in.
Did you have an occasion on Colin's, I guess it would be his third Christmas when he was turning 2 years old? Tell us about taking him for photos.
Yeah, my mother had got me some coupons or something for Sears to get a photo of Colin for his second birthday. And I finally wound up going like just before Christmas. And the store was very crowded. And it was a tough day for me. My mother was with me, and Colin just did not want to be there. He was always trying to struggle out of my arms. When we finally got through the line, he got to the pictures, he would not sit still. He was crying the whole time. And I just was just bewildered. And, you know, my mother even said that there's something wrong with him. I just wasn't, you know, seeing because I was so close to it. But, you know, that was the first time someone ever really, or I really thought about, you know, that there was some kind of problem. I mean, he had some little issues before that time, but that was the first time it kind of like made me think a little bit.
Tell me about after 20 months, the fall of 2000, Colin's park play and what he did in the fall of 2000 and spring of 2001.
Well, a lot of our activities were... we were still trying to do them. We were still doing them, but it was just becoming more and more difficult because Colin's behaviors were getting worse. I'd take him to the park, and he would only want to sit in that tube that he used to climb through all the time, and he wouldn't touch the keys on the piano anymore. He didn't have the energy or the activity that he had previously. I would put him up on the slide, and he would just sit there. He would not slide down the slide, and I was... perplexed by that, and I remember mentioning to Maria, I'm like, you know, he's not going down the slide anymore, and just didn't understand.
At some point, were you with your wife when Colin's initial diagnosis was made?
Yes.
Tell me about that.
I went to see Dr. Fish.
Right.
When he gives the official diagnosis, you know, tough day. You know, But it all, you know, kind of came together with that, the culmination of our struggle that last 6 months. And, you know, then we, you know, just had to get tough and take action.
At some point, when you say take action, did you make a decision to essentially start interacting or taking over Colin's care? When did that happen, and how did it come about?
Well, I was, you know, was Mr. Mom during the week, and, you know, I was always very good with him. He always responded well to me because I was, you know, like the drill sergeant. And you know, then we got into the we got tipsy going, and you know, we got some after school hours, home therapist in, and we just started, you know, on our road to his recovery.
Okay. What role did you play on that in terms of deciding to retire from the fire department? Is that a decision you planned on making?
Oh, no. I enjoyed the department. And you know, I was very good with him. I was basically his therapist at large, and ran his home program. You know, my wife was working again, and like I said, I had a very good functional control over him that, you know, was very difficult for most people just because he was so used to me. And, you know, I basically take care of all his needs and transportation, feed him, and, you know, just keep working on his behaviors.
Why don't you contrast for me going to the beach with Colin pre-20 months and then maybe, you know, at 2 or 2.5 years old?
Well, like I said, we were road warriors. We were always out doing things. The beach was one of our favorites prior to his illness, and he loved it. We'd get there, spend an hour or two there, run around the water, and even all year long, really, because, you know, we get a nice day, we'd still take a ride out there because there'd be nobody there and just enjoy the beach and the waves. And I completely loved that activity as he, you know, I also took him to the zoo. Queens has many, many places for us to spend an afternoon to kill time and, you know, expose the kids to interesting things. And then after he got sick that summer of, you know, the following summer when 2001, I remember trying to take him to the beach and complete meltdown. Didn't want to touch the sand, didn't want to go anywhere near it, couldn't even get him out of the car. And, you know, through therapy, they just told us to keep, you know, keep taking it back, keep taking it back until he gets over his anxiety. And, you know, all that summer I kept taking him, and we'd take a 45-minute ride out there, put one toe in the sand, or, you know, I'd drag him down to the water, put his feet in the water real quick, and then we'd leave. And just kept doing that over and over. And, you know, today he loves the water now. We go to Jones Beach all the time after school, and he swims for an hour. And, you know, it's a long, hard road, but he does respond and can recover from, you know, the anxieties and difficulties he has with these situations.
And you've been able to hear your wife's testimony today. Prior to 20 months of age, did Colin ever engage in any self-injurious behavior?
Prior to 20 months, no.
Prior to 20 months of age, did you ever see him engage in any obsessive-compulsive types of behavior, such as lining the blocks or the eggs that your wife talked about?
No.
Okay. When did those type of behaviors evolve?
You know, in the fall and early in 2001, all those behaviors started coming out. We did a lot of hand flapping. That started, you know, during that time. The lining, the obsessive behavior, the not wanting to wear clothes. It was very, very rough, you know, winter for us.
Tell us about the development of the hand flapping.
It was just something we'd never seen before. And he would be like looking out of the corner of his eyes to see his hands like this. And it was, you know, self-stimulatory behavior. Also, he became obsessed with hair, like he'd come up behind Maria or anybody and just start stroking their hair. You know, he wanted dolls, so he'd see a doll in the store and he'd want the doll just to play with the hair. just a lot of these behaviors started coming out in full force. And then when he started going to tipsy in June there, the headbanging came into play and he would smash his head on the floor violently. And they'd call me for tipsy and I'd have to come and get him, you know.
Compare Colin's interaction with his brother pre-20 months with his post-20 post 20-month interaction with this sibling?
Well, they were like Irish twins, you know. I mean, they were 16 months apart, and Colin followed them around everywhere, and it was a beautiful thing. Like I said, we were, you know, three happy guys hanging on Bayside, you know.
What about post 20 months?
Did not interact with his brother, did not like when his brother came near him. You know, basically, like if you put him by himself, Colin, he would be okay. You know, but any time like other people came in or you tried to engage him in something that he didn't want to be engaged in, you know, then the behaviors would come out.
Tell me about today. What are Colin's functional capabilities? And tell me about what you're working with him on now.
Right now, in the afternoons, we're doing mostly community-based therapy on him because he still can't sit in a restaurant. I mean, now I have him sitting in McDonald's eating French fries, but, you know, we'd like to graduate to something higher end like Applebee's or something, you know, where we can all sit down and have a meal together like a legitimate family. But we're still a little bit away from that. Also, he's much better in stores now. He can wait on lines. This summer I had him up in Lake George, and I took him and his brother and his two cousins to a water park by myself, which I was very proud of. And he actually waited on lines beautifully. So when it's a preferred activity, he's getting better at waiting and, not being so obsessive about, you know, cutting the line or throwing a tantrum because he's not going down the slide immediately. So I was very proud of him this summer when he did that.
What concerns do you have for Colin in terms of the future?
I don't sleep nights thinking about the future. If I can't get him to a place where he can function independently, I worry about his brother not being able to take care of him and winding up in a group home or, you know, someplace where he could be abused or lonely.
I don't think I have anything else.
Ready to continue, Mr. Dwyer?
Yeah.
I have no questions for you, Mr. Dwyer. Thank you very much. You may step down. Is that it for today, Mr. Powers?
Yes, Special Master. Petitioner has nothing else today. As we described in opening, and as you described, we'll have Dr. Mumper available at 8 a.m. tomorrow.
Right. And then the plan for tomorrow is to follow Dr. Mumper with Dr. Leventhal and any rebuttal if necessary, and we'll proceed then into closing arguments.
That's correct, Special Master.
All right, so I think we have a plan for tomorrow. I thank you all very much. Court's in recess.